Well, welcome everybody. Thanks for coming. My name is Susan Jarvis. I'm the president and CEO here in Sanford and Bemidji. And we thought we would maybe do introductions and then tell you a little bit about what we'd like to communicate and then give you the opportunity to ask any questions that you'd like to ask. So I don't know if we'll start over here, maybe just go around the room so we all know who everybody is.
Sure. I believe I've introduced myself, but no worries. I'm Stacy Cashler, communication specialist here at Sanford Health Park.
I'm Tina Halver. I provide infection prevention for Nielsen Place and Bagley Clinical Access Hospital in Clifton.
I'm Lori Fallis. I'm also in infection prevention and for the hospital and clinics.
Colleen Swank. I'm vice president of clinic and also a pediatrician.
Lindsay Wongberg. I am the director of marketing.
I'm Steve Rith, Nigerian. I'm a family physician here at Sanford.
I'm Larissa Donovan, news director at Paul Bunny Broadcasting.
Oh, now I could have, because I get your every night. I get one person, the voice of Bemidji. Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Kev Jackson with Paul Bunyan Broadcasting.
Another voice of Bemidji.
Yeah, there you go.
Now, and another voice of Bemidji.
There could only be one.
Mark Ritchie with RP Broadcasting.
John Enger with Minnesota Public Radio.
Joy Johnson, I'm the Vice President of Operations for Bemidji, Sanford.
Matthew Woodkey, Bemidji Pioneer.
Cynthia Borgen, Public Health Director for Beaufremont County.
Dave Wilcox, a family physician and the Vice President Medical Officer for Sanford Health.
And I'm Kelly Hagan, Vice President for Nursing and Clinical Services.
Destiny Riggins, News Reporter at Lakeland News.
And I'm Anna with the Pioneer
too. Well, again, thank you so much for coming. It's great to meet those of you that I haven't met. I'm fairly new to the Bemidji community, so it's good to put faces with names. Couple of things we just wanted to to lead off with is we have at Sanford here, we have tested for some patients. We have not had any positive tests so far at Sanford. That most likely is going to change. And the other thing is that we are basically, it's pretty much business as usual around here. We are doing a lot of planning and we're doing a lot of preparation. We put a lot of things in place, but we're open for business. We're seeing patients in our clinics. We're still doing elective surgeries and plan to continue that. So right now it's pretty much business as usual, plus the planning that we're doing for our first potential case that may happen. So what we'd like to go over with you today is just have one of the physicians speak a little bit about the background of the coronavirus and COVID-19 and how it evolved and what it means and what the signs and symptoms are. Also then, if a patient feels like they might have been exposed or either have symptoms, what would happen and what we would like to happen and how we'd like to be notified so that we can do the testing. A little bit about public health and community services, and Cynthia will talk to us about that. And then just going forward, what we need people to do to stay healthy and as healthy as possible, and what to do if they get sick. So we thought we'd start with Dr. Wilcox telling us the background, and you may know some of this stuff because a lot of this has been out on with the CDC and the public briefings and that kind of thing, but thought we'd start at the very beginning.
Great. So coronavirus in general is a very common virus that has a cycle every year. Most of us will get coronavirus maybe more than once in our lifetime. So it's something unique, or not unique to us in general. The unique piece is this is a brand new virus, so our immunity isn't quite as up to speed as it would be in a normal case where we could get over this quite simply. If you get exposed to the coronavirus, which is the current mode of transmission, to be directly exposed, typically over a longer period of time, which means hours or care or in the home or in the hospital as a caregiver. It takes that amount of time to acquire the virus and get sick. If you are exposed and become ill with COVID-19, the vast majority of people recover on their own, just like they do with influenza. It's important to understand that influenza is still the largest viral killer in the United States and the world so far. About 80% of people will get better with only treatment of managing their temperature, drinking fluids, and staying home. And we really want that group of people to stay home. If we can assess that they're not too sick, it would be best if they're not out in the community spreading this virus. About 15% of people who get sick with COVID-19 will need to be hospitalized, and we have all the facilities and the necessary treatment and the skill to manage these patients. This is not new work for us. About 5% will become critically ill and end up requiring an intensive care situation, some with or without ventilators. That's a big issue in the country. And about 1% may die. That's the current state that we know from what's going on in the world today. So that's the biology of the disease and how it works, and the awareness of our facilities and our preparation to manage these patients.
So Colleen, if somebody thinks they have been exposed, what are signs and symptoms that they would look for?
So signs and symptoms typically are body aches, fatigue, fever, cough, respiratory difficulty. Some people can have all of those symptoms, some people just have some. Most people do have fever though. Runny nose is also another symptom.
And then Dr. Rithnagerian, if someone feels like they've been exposed or has some of those symptoms, then what should they do and then what would happen?
Well, ideally they should, you know, call before coming on in so that we can have a conversation with them to determine what their risk is. And if there is concern that they've had exposure or they've had some travel to an area where it's endemic or they've had some actual contact with somebody and they're having symptoms, then screening them for possible COVID-19 would be appropriate. And we would have them come on in and we would put them in a isolated room. We have a special procedure for safely acquiring the screening test and sending that off to the appropriate laboratory at the state for confirmation testing. At that point, if there's concern, we'd have the patient self-isolate, and they're healthy, they're not requiring hospitalization, we'd have them go home, okay, stay at home. And if the test comes back positive, then they would undergo what we call home isolation and quarantine for those people immediately around them. So, for example, let's say your mother comes on in and is sick, coughing, she's been home for the past couple of days, the test comes back positive. The public health department would be contacted, they would come into the home and they would help that family understand what they need to do to take care of themselves. Specifically, they would isolate themselves within the house, they'd have appropriate precautions, wearing masks, their own bathroom, whatever, it all has to be done within the feasibility of that person's home and arrangements. And then those household contacts who will be caring for those people will have to exercise extra precaution to not spread it. We call that quarantine, staying at home. You only go on out for essential purposes like medical care. Did I miss anything, our public health expert?
I think that was pretty good. One aspect is in the state of Minnesota, the monitoring activities for isolation and quarantine typically happen from MDH, the state health department. So they're the ones who would be connecting with the family to assure that they understand what they need to do in order to keep the family safe and to reduce exposures as much as possible. The role that local public health would have in that situation is working with the state health department and the family to assure that they have the essential services that they need, to work with the family to figure out how to make sure they've got adequate food, that they have appropriate ways for communicating with MDH and with others, and whatever other issues there would be, we would work with them to help make sure those needs are met.
So there's been a lot of questions about a lot of discussion in the media about testing and how that testing works, and is there enough testing, and are we testing enough people? So Kelly, talk a little bit about testing and what it looks like at this point for us.
Certainly. So if a patient, if we did deem that the patient needed to be tested, the testing is the same as it is for influenza. We use a swab, we get some specimen from the back of the nose and the throat, and we put that into the container. We send that off to a laboratory. Testing is not done locally, but the obtainment of the test is done locally and sent off to the laboratory for testing.
And right now that's the Department of Health.
And right now
it's going to the Minnesota Department of Health.
And right now we have swabs adequate for the population at hand. We do not anticipate any issue to test those who need to be tested.
But there are criteria for testing. It's not just, you know, I call up and say, hey, I want to be tested. You have to have, there has to be a reason to test you. So, I don't know, Dr. Wilcox or Callie, you want to talk about when we would test someone?
Yeah, we're currently following the CDC guidelines for testing. So, minor disease is not necessarily a reason to have a test if you're able to manage at home. We would test to help decide what part of the hospital you need to go to. We will test people who meet the CDC criteria.
And we've not had any limitations put on us as far as like do test, don't test. We follow the criteria, and all tests that we've deemed necessary have been run. And as I said, we have not had any positives. And then the last thing we just wanted, I was going to ask Colleen to talk about. So what do people need to do? This is a scary thing, I think, for everybody. It's obviously in the media. Events are being canceled. Why are we doing that, and what do we need people to do and know?
Well, I think the big thing is not to panic. You know, you're hearing online about stores running out of toilet paper and bottled water, and we really don't think that is necessary. We also don't think that healthy people without symptoms need to be masked. There really isn't any evidence that shows that protects anybody, and it just kind of heightens the anxiety, in my opinion. With all the cancellations, I mean, really what we're trying to do, we know that this is in our country, and we know, as Dr. Wilcox said, that there's going to be a percentage of people that need hospital beds and ventilators and all of those things. We also know that we don't have immunity to this new disease. And so if it comes to a community and spreads quickly and everybody gets sick all at once, then that overwhelms the health system, and we don't have the resources for that. I'm speaking in general in the United States, not Bemidji specifically. And so then if we can have some of our social distancing, not spread this rapidly, move it out a little bit, then the fewer people will get sick, mm-hmm. but then maybe even more importantly, they won't get sick all at once. It'll spread it out, and it'll stay over that threshold so that we can care for everybody. That's my biggest fear in this country, is that people that would normally be able to be treated for anything, for a car accident or a heart attack or whatever, that they won't be able to be treated because of an influx, because the resources are being utilized because of this illness. And so I guess that's my biggest concern is that when people say, well, I'm young and healthy, everybody's going to get it anyways, I'm just going to, you know, it's dumb that we've canceled this hockey game or whatever. And this is really what we're trying to prevent, and that's what I want people to understand. So maybe more on an individual level, other than not going to crowded places, what other things can people do? If you're sick but healthy, stay at home. If you are having respiratory symptoms and do feel you need to seek medical care, call ahead so that we can prepare for you when you come in. That way, we don't have somebody possibly infecting other people as they're walking through the waiting room. We can plan for you. At home, making sure that you're cleaning off your surfaces. Just simple things like taking Clorox wipes and wiping off the doorknobs and different things. People that own businesses, if they could increase their cleaning of those surfaces during the day when they have people coming into their businesses, that would be also wonderful. Cough etiquette, so remembering to cough in your sleeve rather than in your hand. Hand washing, I know everybody's getting sick of hand washing. And by the looks on the shelves, I think people must not have ever washed their hands before this. But great, whatever it takes. Hopefully when this goes away, we'll continue up that practice, because I would love it if influenza season was more mild every year. So, I already talked about face masks for those that are healthy. We will face mask people that come into our buildings that do have respiratory symptoms, though, and that's to prevent their coughs from getting onto other people.
And we have a supply of those masks.
We have plenty of supply of those masks.
And I think the local community hoarding masks to try to protect themselves is not appropriate. It's not recommended by the CDC, and it takes away from those people who really need those masks to care for patients. So the mask issue is a big deal for proper use and who should be masking and who should not. Putting on a mask of a sick patient is a considerable amount of protection. It keeps their secretions out of the community. And when we have sick and older and the more at-risk patients in our facilities, we do not want a mild case to contaminate one of those people at the highest risk of dying. And it's why we've made fairly stringent restrictions in our facilities about visitors coming in. We already have in hospitals sick patients, old patients, immune suppressed patients. So we will really protect those patients the best we can. When you come in or before you come in, calling is really important because there are pretty rigid criteria about who should be tested and who shouldn't. And if you don't need to be part of the line to get tested, so to speak, we would rather not use that resource. So that's why calling is really important as the first mode if you have questions. If it's general questions, there's public lines, there's Minnesota Department of Health question lines, the CDC has great information. If you really think you're sick and need to be treated for your illness, then it's time to call your private office.
And right now that's the advice that we're giving to the public is for general questions. The Minnesota Department of Health has a hotline that's been published all over the place, and maybe Cynthia, you can share that line number. And that's for, you know, general questions that someone might have just about the disease or, you know, what they should do in the community, that kind of thing. But if they personally have what they believe is potentially COVID-19, we're asking them to call their doctor's office. And we have staff that are directing them, going through the screening questions, and if they meet the criteria, then we are very deliberately setting up a time for them to come in and meet with, and they're met at the door, they can be masked at that time, and so that we can protect them and everyone else in our facility while we do the test. So it's really important that people call before they just arrive. And I think sometimes the reflex is to go to the ER. I mean, I think that's the easy button, kind of, or go to walk-in. And we're really needing to get the word out to the community that they need to call their PCP's office, their primary care provider's office, if they think they personally need to be tested. And we can go through that process with them and make sure that if they meet the criteria, they get the test, but we do it in a way that they stay safe and so do the rest of the patients in our clinics and hospitals and our staff.
Yeah, if we do see an influx, we do need to keep the ER open for those patients that really need the ER. And so if we can help triage people over the phone to help them decide. We definitely want to make sure we're seeing the people that need to be seen. And so I would never tell somebody that they have to stay at home, but can we triage them to the best place?
I think it's really important to understand that the treatment of COVID-19 is supportive, much like the treatment of the usual influenza. So it's taking your temperature, taking fever-reducing medications, maintaining adequate hydration. There's no drug that will make you better faster, and so those are the treatments. If you need more treatment than that, that usually means oxygen, respiratory support, IV fluids. So that's when you need to come to the hospital, is when you think you're so sick that you could need oxygen, IV fluids, and support of your vital organs and health. So that's why the call first is important. We'll always go through some screenings to decide kind of how sick you are. It's why those people with diseases that already affect their important organs, like their lungs and their heart and their immune system, are at highest risk. So if that's the primary treatment for 80% of the people, all of that can be managed at home. You can take fluids at home until you can't keep them down. You can use fever reducers at home until your fever is not controllable. So that's another important part, is that the treatment, and for most people, it's quite simple.
And during that time that you're at home, to make sure you're isolating yourself so you're not exposing others.
So now we'll just open it up for any questions that you guys have.
Is there like any timeline, or it's like it just seems like we're doing this now? Is there an indicator of what's next, or how does that part go?
Well, unfortunately, we don't absolutely know the pattern for COVID-19. We don't know if this will be seasonal like most of the coronaviruses. Familiar epidemics that we've had are MERS and SARS, which were both coronaviruses, and they kind of burned out in a few months. And worldwide had just a few thousand patients get sick. So we don't know if it's going to follow that pattern, or if it's something that will come in our community, will develop immunity, and it will wax and wane over a period of time. It's really important to understand this peak. When we're not very immune and can't fight it off well, if it spikes up, it will overwhelm our resources. If we can socially isolate, kind of keep that peak low, if it's doing this kind of activity, even if it's over several years' time, we will be able to manage that, just like we manage influenza, which you're familiar with. It has a pretty classic peak, then burns out and goes away. We don't know for sure, but we're hopeful that this will not be ongoing at this high rate.
At this status that we're at of this heightened security, and this is going to continue canceling things, this type of activity will continue until we don't know, or is there any?
So in a pandemic, there's typically four phases. And so the first phase of a pandemic is containment, and that's kind of what we've been doing now, trying to slow those cases as they've talked, keep that curve down so we don't have so much presentation. The next phase is the community mitigation phase, and that's where we're just starting to see some of that cranking up. That's where we would look at the starting, canceling of gatherings so that people are not, together. Thinking about actions that workplaces could take to help their employee workforce stay safer, whether it means going on to two shifts instead of one shift so that only half the spots are being used in a manufacturing facility and you've got people at least 6 feet apart. You may see schools taking some actions where maybe they no longer are doing their special activities and they're not doing big gatherings in the gym or in the in an auditorium, so that kids are pretty much just with their class each day, so that we're limiting that contact broadly with a broad population. There will be a lot of activities that happen, and that will be something that we'll look to CDC and Minnesota Department of Health for guidance on what activities we should be taking. We'll see that ramp up in those community mitigation strategies, and then we'll get to a point where we'll just be looking at managing the pandemic, at making sure we're maintaining adequate healthcare resources, we're communicating with folks. During that management is what's happening now in many countries around the world, where they're looking at what do we need to continue to do, what can we stop. Then we get to that demobilization, and so China is thinking about, are we in some of that demobilization where now we're relaxing our travel restrictions, where we're opening up workforces and schools that maybe had been closed for a while. And so those are, that's the theory of pandemics and the stages that we go through. We're just at the start, and we have no way to know. If you look at some of the different countries, some of them have been able to keep their cases significantly lower than others. Italy was blasted with cases, and so there's people now looking at what did they do right, what did other countries do wrong. So we're still considering what those actions are, and we're relying heavily
on the CDC and the Minnesota Department of Health to give us guidance on what should we do today and what should we do tomorrow, and how do we work as a community to make sure we're providing consistent messaging across the community so everyone understands when to present to healthcare and how to present to healthcare, that people who perhaps are at high risk are thinking about, ooh, maybe now's a good time for me to kind of hunker down and I'm going to limit my exposures to others. So there's actions that we're looking at individuals taking. There'll be actions we'll be looking to community organizations and businesses and schools to take as we look. And as a community, this afternoon we're meeting with a variety of sectors across the community to talk about this very thing, about what should we be doing now, and are we all planning for what we need to do next when we start seeing cases in Beltran County.
And I like an analogy you used earlier, which is this is a dial of techniques, and we're just starting to turn the dial up. Unless you can predict the future, you don't know how high to turn it when and how when to turn it back down. So that's a good analogy for how we apply these principles. And we're very early on that, you know, larger travel restrictions, big gatherings, people from all different places, you know, that 100-person event kind of a thing in the more sick communities. Right now, since we have no known cases in Bemidji, we're very early on in that dial and haven't needed to do any of that yet.
You know, and we are doing some things from a community mitigation perspective that are less dramatic, maybe. Some of our visitation restrictions that we've put in place in our long-term care facilities are to protect those folks that are there, because we know that that's a really vulnerable population. We've seen in other communities how that can impact a facility. So we're doing some of those early community mitigation things, like canceling sporting events, things that aren't critical. And, you know, we want people to have visitors, but we want them to have them as safely as possible. So we're screening patients and visitors when they come in the door to make sure if they have any kind of respiratory symptoms that we're masking them, so we're keeping everybody safe. But we can do some of those things that are sort of less invasive now when we know we're potentially getting closer to that mitigation phase, just to keep it in that low realm instead of getting the peaks that some of the other countries experienced.
And our elderly are very critical. The average age of someone who dies right now is 80. And I don't know the exact age, but the average age of people who are sick enough to require resources in the 50s and 60s. So you're hearing that message, you know, 60 and up, start thinking about your travel plans. Keep the nursing home free of other people who could bring it into them, because 80 years of age is the average age of death.
And obviously that's the population in our nursing homes and our assisted living. And so this is just a way for us to try to keep them as safe as we can.
So you guys are talking about trying not to overwhelm your resources. Bemidji is a population center for, I think, north of 100,000 people. You said, was it 5% that need to be hospitalized of the people that get sick, roughly? 5%?
15% may need hospitalization, 5% may need intensive care.
Okay. 15% need hospitalization. If some of the projections I'm seeing are accurate for the number of people that will be infected, you're looking at huge numbers of people that you'll have to handle. I mean, I guess, what are your numbers capabilities? Can you talk about that?
Well,
that's one of the reasons the community is doing the things it's doing. That's why you're seeing, I mean, part of what you're seeing, like this many people could be infected, is to help people understand why we need to bend that curve. Because if we would, I mean, the whole entire U.S. healthcare system would be overwhelmed if some of the projections I've seen are true, and you've seen that, like, in different articles.
Nationwide, there's 2.8 hospital beds for every 1,000 people nationwide. So, yeah, the math doesn't work if everybody gets sick at once.
Is that about the average here, too?
That's a good question.
I don't know the answer to that, but probably. But I think the point is that's the mitigation strategies that are happening right now. That's why. Because the intent is, if you can limit socialization in your communities at large events like the hockey playoffs, then that curve isn't this, it's this. And we can manage that because we have the resources over a period of time if people are gradually contracting the disease rather than all at once. And I think that's what some of the other countries experienced, where they maybe didn't have some of the early mitigation strategies, and or it could have been that they are just more densely populated than our market. I mean, there are some real advantages if you're rural. You can just stay home and not see anyone for a couple weeks, you know. But
that's just normal, right?
Yeah.
That's what we want to be doing anyway.
Yeah. Right.
Come on, your fish.
Right.
I would say that we have been meeting and preparing on this even before this pandemic. We had preparations around Ebola a few years ago. This is not Ebola. But you know, we had preparations around H1N1. Back in 2009, which I was not here, and I was not with Sanford, but we had a huge influx of patients where I was working down in North Carolina. But so we are fortunate that we are part of Sanford Health, a large healthcare organization. We have a lot of resources. We have a lot of expertise. We have a lot of hospital beds throughout our footprint. We have a lot of long-term care facilities. And so it's not just, we don't have to just rely on our resources in Bemidji. We have the opportunity to rely on resources from a larger organization, which is very helpful in these types of events. We practice every year a surge. So we, for our accreditation, we have to say, okay, if we surged with X number of patients, how are we going to handle that? So we have plans in place for how we do that. It is just going to be much better for the entire healthcare system if it is not a huge bolus all at one time.
Has there been any communications with the three regional Native American reservations or anything from a public health perspective? Or I was just wondering if they've, just in case, even those who don't live on the reservations, but Red Lake Band members or Leech Lake Band members who live close by, has there been anything with that?
So we have invited both Red Lake and Leech Lake to our community planning meeting, and we regularly work with them on a variety of things. Leech Lake had just yesterday released some information for their band members about what they're recommending from their point of view. And so we will continue to work with them. We also work regionally. In Minnesota, we have 8 regional health coalitions where we work both with healthcare, public health, long-term care, and clinics, where we support each other in learning about what we're doing around planning, as well as what we're learning from real events and exercises that we do. So there's been money going to emergency preparedness for the last 20 years, and both public health and healthcare have been doing planning around this. A lot of that happens behind the scenes, and which is great if we don't have to implement those plans, but there has been a lot of work that's been going on for a long time to help us be as ready as we can be when now all of a sudden we're faced with COVID-19.
And I know with this event, that emergency preparedness regional coalition has been meeting more frequently, and they've been talking a lot about transfers and how they get the resources to where they're needed in a real time. And so they are meeting even more than once a week, a couple times a week, and the tribes are involved in that, as are long-term care facilities, as well as ambulance services, law enforcement. It's a very broad group, but they do have, like Cynthia said, they have an ongoing planning process, but obviously it's ramped up in the last couple months.
Couple days,
yeah. I think they met twice yesterday, actually.
Think of the dial, you know, we began our emergency threat. We have an emergency threat planning team as Sanford Health as a whole, which meets about quarterly to review stuff. But every time we've had a new issue come up, Ebola was the latest, you know, serious event, and we've done the same. So we've been making plans since January to be prepared for this. And it's, we meet three times a week now. It, you know, we dial that up and down as we see fit for each crisis.
So we meet three times a week with that group, but we also meet daily locally. So, yeah.
So we have our incident command. We have an incident command structure, and we actually have stood that up so that we have our structure in place so that we can, in a timely way, be proactive and also responsive to issues that arrive. So Kelly's our incident commander for COVID-19, and so she meets every morning with key members of the staff here in Bemidji. We've done town halls for the staff, daily communication, more than daily, a lot of communication going out there. So,
and we connect with the enterprise plus use CDC as our source of truth. So that's how we kind of operate in that regard.
So we live in this hyper-politicized world where everything is seen through that prism. How is that affecting you guys with the boots on the ground here? Or is it?
I would say it's not really affecting us. We're just preparing and taking care of patients, and that's what we're doing in the processes.
And there are some, you know, there are some federal initiatives, and they're considering legislation around this issue, and they've already passed some legislation. So I think the good news is that it has been pretty bipartisan in terms of support for getting the kinds of things that we need to have done. There are some other things that they're working on to try to get in place that would make it easier for us to implement emergency measures, and we've been working with our public policy people to try to get some of those things through. But there has been pretty good bipartisan support for the things that we've need to had happen.
Will tests be available to those who are uninsured?
Yes.
Okay.
That was already passed.
All right.
And just a couple interesting things. We, you know, as a Sanford Enterprise, we do have a centralized laboratory, and they are working on our own testing. I think yesterday you saw that Mayo has developed their test, although I think they're still using the Department of Health until it gives through whatever
emergency FDA
stuff, yeah, approvals that has to go through. So that is, you know, we will probably have our own test. I don't know what the time frame will be. And then Sanford Research is actually also working on the vaccine down in Sioux Falls.
I'd read last night that a university, I think in Saskatchewan, had been working on a vaccine. If a vaccine is eventually successful, what is the timeline of that implementation to where it's fully implemented with the public and that immunity can pick up a bit? What is a timeline like that for?
It's a tough question,
yeah.
Just because you have to go through so many steps to make sure that it's safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anywhere from 6 to 18 months,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of times it's closer to the 18 months.
H1N1 took around a year?
12, yeah.
Yeah.
And even then, it came out in small quantities initially,
mm-hmm.
so they
yep.
needed to determine who gets this first
mm-hmm.
precious batch. So, again, depending upon how they need to create the vaccine, if it's a chicken egg vaccine, then that really extends
mm-hmm.
the time frame. There's lots of people working on vaccine
mm-hmm.
right now, but we don't know.
It won't do anything to mitigate this potential surge.
Sure.
So we need to be aware of that. I think a message for us is that Sanford Health is prepared as we can be.
Mm-hmm.
We're really counting on our community to do their fair share and be prepared and do the public health actions that are so simple. Wash your hands, cover your cough, stay home if you're sick. Those are the things that will limit the spread far more than anything we do at Sanford Health. So your public message is the most important part of this meeting, which is to try to reduce the hype, you know, keep the politics out of it. We're here to take care of patients. We're here to protect our patients. We're here to protect our community. And we're ready to go, providing it's eased in,
mm-hmm.
not shocked in. So,
and if you have general questions, the MDH hotline is a great resource for folks. And that number is 651-201-3920. And so we'd love to have you help us get that number out, because then that reduces the number of calls coming to Sanford that are just general
basic
calls.
Questions.
Yeah.
What about the just the materials you guys are going to need. I think you mentioned you had quite a few masks, quite a few swabs. I'm assuming you're going to need IV bags, ventilators, oxygen. Where are you guys with that?
You want to speak to that?
Sure. So right now we have everything we need to care for all of our patients. We are asking everybody to use our resources with good stewardship to make sure that we're using what we need but not overusing supplies. As with the scare for toilet paper and water, there's a scare for masks, and everybody believes they need a mask, and they don't. Healthy people do not need a mask, and so we ask that people not do those things so that there's not a mixed message about what the need is. So we're using good stewardship, good planning. We have a really great approach to resource planning and giving us what we need as we need it for what we need it for. So right now we don't have issues, but we are always watching that every single day, and that's one of the touch points that we discuss at our incident command and then with our enterprise. We're very fortunate to have the system that we do at Sanford because of our ability to have enough supply throughout our system. So
flex from one place to the other.
So you'll have enough if you're careful, basically.
Our public is careful.
Yeah.
I can't stress the public. You know, it's a big deal. If everybody who doesn't need a mask thinks they have to have 10 at home, then the caregivers who are actually taking care of patients will not have them.
Correct. The CDC is also watching supplies and management of supplies across the country, so they're managing all of that. They're also working with industry to identify other sources of protective equipment that we may use in healthcare. So a lot of the masks that are made are not necessarily used in healthcare. In the industry, they're used for construction, for other types of industry, and so they're looking at how that can be transitioned to supply healthcare as well.
If we need it, contingency planning.
But right now we have what we need to take care of patients, and we have a great process to giving supply to where it's needed and yet not oversupplying places that don't.
In Sanford, we have great people working in the supply chain and working with manufacturers and distributors of the items that we need, both pharmaceutical and then non-pharmaceutical. So we get updates on that, I guess, daily now. But even, you know, even before COVID-19, when there's drug shortages or other things, they're constantly in contact with us. So it's just ramped up now.
And I think it's important to understand this disease. This disease is droplet spread, getting coughed on, exposed to secretions, sneezed on, by someone who's a known case. Within 6 feet, that's a bit of a danger. Outside 6 feet, that gets aerosolized to a level that's not that communicable. And so that's a really important part of it. The families, those in the home, the patient, that's who needs the mask. The caregivers, that's who needs the mask. So that's where the community help in reducing this spread is very important.
So is it safe to report that this immediate response that happened here this week was to keep the surge down, was the efforts that it may seem dramatic, but it really isn't in the scope of things? Mm-hmm. I don't think that a lot of the general public,
understand
you can
that.
See what they're doing. They're going to buy toilet paper. So,
yeah.
But
yeah.
We're also not... But our medias are, our news medias are blowing things up and they're making headlines and people are tuning in,
right.
And that's our job. But on the other side, we have to let the public know, and I think that we're all trying to find answers, and I got the answers here today. I mean, of course I would rather have the hockey game this weekend, but that's nothing compared to a healthy community,
mm-hmm.
And I don't think people are able to make those connections, but today... thank you for what you do, and I think I know we can, and you guys will be able to report as well, and give everybody a better understanding of why it happened so quickly. Because we started hearing about it, I know you guys too, in November, October in China, and what were you guys, I mean, if there was nothing going on, and all of a sudden, wonder why there wasn't this immediate impact in November and December, because obviously it was going to go across the globe, right?
The first case was in December, and it took a little while to know what it was. And so then once it was discovered there, then, you know, containment started to happen in China. But I think I think behind the scenes there was a lot of ramping up, because I remember our first small meeting about it was either at the end of, I think it was the beginning of January.
First week or two of January, we started our planning from that emergency threats group.
But it's always a balance, right? Because you don't want to panic. And there have been other coronaviruses that have gone from animal to human, SARS and MERS, which didn't end up being as was easily contained, more easily contained. And so I think that that's the difference, is that it wasn't as easily contained. The spread was faster because people aren't as sick, and so it's just easier to get through the population.
Do you guys have any phrases that we can use that will help the audiences understand?
Hashtag flatten the curve.
Facts over fear.
Yeah. Yep. And I think, a little bit to help answer your question is that we have moved into this community mitigation stage that Cynthia referenced. And that's where you try to limit socialization between people. And we didn't need to do that when there weren't any cases in the state or in the country. And obviously the hope was that it wouldn't get there, that it would be contained in China. That obviously did not happen. And so as we have seen the spread, the mitigation is essential for us to limit that curve, flatten the curve.
And I would say we started asking the travel questions, it's been a few weeks ago now. So. Knowing that it was in China, so we started, every patient that presented got asked if you'd traveled to any of, started with China, and then we've had to add other countries. And if they had, and then if they had any symptoms, and we have an algorithm for how those were treated. So we put that into place, that's been several weeks ago.
How have you interacted with places like Bemidji State, or School District, or Sanford Center, places like that?
So they call us regularly. We call them, they call us.
Yeah.
And then we have planned meetings with them.
So.
And we just worked yesterday, for example. The students were supposed to come back on Monday, and they have 5,000 students who were just on spring break, so travel was probably a part of their lives. And so we coordinated yesterday with their student health center about what they should do with students. And in fact, in a couple of circumstances, they had gotten calls from students who were in a place, coming back from a place where, and this was before they canceled classes for the week, but we worked with them on communicating exactly the same steps we've communicated to you, what they should do if they come back, if they have symptoms, how they should be treated. You know, don't send them to the ER. I mean, that was the natural response, I think, was that they would have just sent them to the ER, but we walked through that with them. So we've coordinated with them from a personal care perspective, too. So I think, we're working, I feel like we have a lot of really good community collaboration today to make sure that everybody understands what they can do to mitigate the spread. So I feel like we've done a pretty good job of heading it off on the front end. And even though people didn't like all the cancellations, obviously, because it destroys your social life, which is why we call it socialization, it's our source of socialization, which we just cut off at the knees, apparently. But I think it's the right thing to do.
And I think right now in Bemidji, your risk of COVID-19 is very, very, very low. It really is. Your risk is very low. This does not come by casual contact, walking by somebody in the airport, sitting in a waiting room is not a high risk. It's probably a higher risk to get influenza still, and that's still our most threatening disease in Bemidji.
Can we say that the risk is low?
In Bemidji, yes.
And these measures are the actions to keep it low?
Correct. Yep. And yes. To avoid the surge, I think that surge concept is really, really important. And so let's help reduce that so we don't overwhelm our systems when people start getting sick. And the other is you'll be informed. I mean, if we see an uptick in cases and illnesses and, this disease starts to enter our community and people are getting hospitalized, we'll keep you appraised of that, because that's, the next dial-up is, what does the community need to do? What do we need to do?
And I think the Department of Health has been pretty transparent about how many cases they've tested positive and where they are and what their condition is. They've been really very forthcoming about that, and I'm assuming that that'll continue, so we'll know.
Well, the governor's speaking in one.
Any
insight
that.
On what's going on with that?
I don't know. I mean, there's been a lot of conversation about school closures, and I think in other states it was the governor who made that call. So I think it might have something to do with schools. That would be my guess. But we are really strongly encouraging not to do that. And maybe you want to talk a little bit about children? I mean, it's...
Well, sure. I mean, when we look at the epidemiology of it and we look at young people, including children, we really are not seeing a lot of cases. And although there may be cases, they're pretty mild cases. So typically the risk to younger people, including children, is pretty low with COVID-19, much lower than it is for those over 65 or over 80. So we know that we've seen a ramp up of cases. I mean, you know, there was one case, then another one, then two more, then four more. We haven't seen yet today what they've, if there are any more presumptive positives from testing that was done yesterday. But I think, again, the goal is it's time to move from just this containment strategy, start turning that dial up on community mitigation activities. So we do anticipate that there will be some action that the governor will take to help support communities in making those decisions about, ooh, yeah, we should probably cancel that event. What can we do in schools that doesn't close a school, but that helps protect kids in school? And there are a lot of strategies that can be done within a school without closing a school so that we keep our economy and our systems running as long as we can with our, you know, pretty normal system. And as we see more cases, we will take more actions to help reduce that. And it's an art as well as a science about what is that right choice. You know, we've got a lot of individual choice in our country. Balancing that with how do we protect each other is something we'll really be looking to MDH for guidance. They'll provide it to us, and then we as a community and as organizations will make those decisions.
Well, it's a balance, right? So it's trying to figure out, you don't want to panic, but you want also want to do the right thing, protect the community. And so the balance is, you know, with school closings, do you close the schools, but then there's an influx of parents now that they can't go to work, which affects the economy. So it's trying to decide what's the right thing. And as you said, it's a little bit of an art, but I think the thing that we have to rely on is the science and not the panic. So we can't just look at the optics of it, but does it truly make sense? I believe that, even though I was going to the hockey game tonight, that canceling the hockey game was the right thing to do. When it comes to closing down an elementary school, I don't know what the right answer is today. I would want to hear more about why we would do that.
And sometimes CDC has recommended a short-term closure. If there's been a case in a student or a staff
exactly.
member, then they recommend let's close the school, send everyone home for maybe 24 hours, do a deep clean of the school, and then look at that contact investigation about who was it who had the virus. How likely was it that they spread it to other individuals? Who was most likely in that high-risk exposure? And then how do we work on quarantining those who were at high risk, but doing our best to keep the rest of the system operating as well as it can? And that's where we want to be aware of all these things that are happening, but we don't want it to cause alarm for everyone.
That was a great way to say it.
Yeah, it may not be the house of cards, because one school closes, it doesn't mean no. It might be one instance in one school, it's temporary, it'll come back up when the proper mitigation strategies have been accomplished.
I think I heard that a Twin Cities school closed this last...
Robbinsdale.
And I assume it was a specific case.
There was a positive.
They knew they had a positive case. And
so yeah, lots of implications if schools close for workforce, you know, with two working parents, you know, all of a sudden you've cut the workforce in half too, for whatever it is.
Yeah.
Your economy, your businesses, your healthcare.
And with our daycare situation in Bemidji, if they were to close the schools, we would have serious
We also have a very
issues to resolve.
We have a very high number of students who get free and reduced lunch, mm-hmm. and without school, food security becomes really questionable in some families. Mm-hmm. So we really do want to make sure that we keep kids in school for a whole bunch of reasons as long as we can.
And that just underscores the whole mitigation thing. This
right.
is, you can't. You have to be able to appreciate the long-term consequences. And, you know, as a nation, we've come together before. Mm-hmm. And this could be one of those times where it allows us to push past the partisanship. So there's a part of me that's hopeful. And we're really grateful that you're here to be part of getting that message out. We're very fortunate here in Bemidji to have a network of people who are connected more than we are pulled apart. So thanks for your sharing that message.